And tonight starts the first of eight classes around a topic I'm choosing to call the story of the me. And we enter a topic of Buddhism that is perhaps the most difficult to get a sense of. Many of you have heard talks about different aspects of Buddhism, such as the nature of change in the world, or the nature of the inherent unsatisfactory quality of experience. And it doesn't require too deep of an experience or too deep of a wisdom for us to get a feeling for the nature of the changing universe, the fact that everything is in flux and is in movement. Even intellectually, we can get a sense of that because we don't have to move out too many decades before we see virtually everything that we have created disintegrating. And even the nature of experience being inherently unsatisfactory is probably one of the driving forces why many people come to meditation to begin with. They just can't find enough satisfaction in their life as they live it to warrant the sort of focused attention that we give to experience and to give to the things that we create. So those aspects of the Dharma or the Buddha's teaching can be approached and understood, and we can rally around those particular truths as something that we can deepen our understanding. But when it comes to this third thing called anatta, selflessness, oftentimes we find ourselves scratching our head in complete confusion. Makes little sense to me. And we may go years into our practice and still not have much of a feel for what this thing called anatta is. And yet it's at the heart of the teaching. It's very hard. My teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, used to say, and he had a monastery in which he invited different traditions of Buddhism to express itself in art. So he had a big gallery of Zen art and Tibetan art. In any case, he used to say that any teaching that has anatta as its base is good teaching. Any teaching that omits it, leave it alone. So unless we come into this subject, we can't say that we really understand Buddhism at its heart of hearts. And how do we approach it? Because it certainly isn't anything that is obvious to us in our experience of everyday sitting, perhaps. And it quite likely isn't taught in the school systems, at least the ones that I'm familiar with. And in fact, the world is at odds very much with this particular principle. It wants you to self, it wants you to have a self, but not too much of one. Heard my niece say the other week, she said, well, he's full of himself. It's going too far, you're selfing it too far. So there's a range in which self is socially acceptable and then a range which it's not. But you've got to be within those parameters to make it work in this society. I think it's interesting how we approach this subject. I wasn't clear how to do that. And so the homework is a large component of this series together. And yet I feel it's so important to try. And we can work the meditation practice relatively successful without ever really focusing on this particular principle of meditation. I mean, if we work it with self-acceptance, allowance, relaxation, ease, openness, we will see ourselves becoming more open, allowing, non-judgmental, accepting. But we will still be very much intact even as we change in the nature of our particular ability to let things in. And so there's something that has to be instilled within this practice that shatters or at least rocks that very concept of need. Or else it's just a method towards self-improvement of becoming, shall I say, nicer people, kinder. And it makes life easier to be kinder. It makes life easier to be nicer, to be more open, to be more flexible. You have less pain. But there's not the ending of pain. It's not the ending of pain. And it takes courage, I think, to want to approach a subject like this. Because what are we going to get out of it? Why would we want to do this? Why do we want to get shaken to our foundation? I was on a retreat last week at IMS teaching. And I gave a talk, an Anatta talk. And I could almost predict the number of notes I'm going to get by how, whether the talk shakes the people or not. And there, of course, there's this wave of, because when people are shaken from the words, they react. They try to get a footholding back. One of the ways to do that is to either denounce the talk as no good or denounce the speaker as no good or do something which kind of gives them a foothold again in their judgment. And yet I virtually every retreat I teach, I try to bring a talk like this forward. Because if it's not there, the teachings are just incomplete. And in fact, they're not just incomplete. Anatta changes a teaching from being psychologically based to being spiritually based. And without that concept, it's just really humanistic psychology that we're practicing. There's not anything wrong with being a better person. I don't want to discourage us in developing our character, because I think, in general, Buddhism has at its basis also character development, which seems paradoxical, but which isn't, because character development can occur simultaneously with our understanding of the emptiness of character. We don't force ourselves to be a particular character. It's not an ambitious quality. It's just what arrives, how our character changes as we allow ourselves to sit without forming a lot of opinions about things. And this opinionlessness awareness brings out our heart. There is definite signs of kindness, of the ability to pay attention, of our willingness to be more accepting. And that character, those character qualities, generosity and patience, humility, ease, are very much an accompanying part of many and most people's journeys on the path. And it happens automatically. It's not something, again, that you have to conjure or force in your practice. And many people get sidetracked on those secondary issues of character development as being the sort of the main focus of what Buddhism is all about. Some people get sidetracked within the concept of kindness. I want to be kinder. I want to be nicer. I want to be good. I want to be a good person. Somehow, much of our spiritual training has led us to believe that it's a process of becoming good. Good. I want to be good. And any time we do that, of course, whatever qualities of our mind we perceive as being the opposite of where we're going, we make a value judgment and a moral statement against, and then we create a huge shadow in opposition to those qualities that we think we want to enhance, opposed to those qualities that we think we want to diminish. And that creates an enormous sense of inward friction. It creates a trumpet call of moralism, shoulds, musts, have-tos. You can just feel the cage get smaller as the moralism gets more verbose. None of that is very healthy from my point of view, because it doesn't contain in the heart of hearts the examination of the person, him or herself. And we can take anything in Buddhism and lace another layer of ourselves to it, like the precepts. If I say, okay, here are the five precepts, and okay, now I've got to not lie. I've got to not harm things. And you can see it forming more of a sense of me, not less than of a sense of me. So unless this central truth is seen for what it is and the direction of the whole tradition behind it, the whole tradition just adds to new layers of self-improvement, self-enhancement. And we can walk right through the Buddhist door and come out the other side full of ourselves. And we see the quality of knowledge, you know, when people get very studious in their Buddhism rather than very practiced in it, and they know all about what the Buddha said and become resolute in that knowledge, you can see that as being another formation of sense of me around the tradition. So how is it that we can go into this thing and understand it so that it really has an impact on us, so that every one of the teachings of the Buddha, when it holds that central truth, adds to the very view and purpose of the diminishment and understanding of me, not to the enhancement and enlargement of me. The Buddha said himself, he said, if you practice from I, you sustain I. Now, when we sit down in our daily practice or our sitting or the weeks of retreating, that is really an opportunity not to work things out in some kind of character way, but as an opportunity to release ourselves from the speed and intentionality of our lives for just that brief period of 40, 45 minutes or however long we sit, and to allow the thing to sort of disintegrate within our attention. Not to just think our problems through, which is how many people relate to their sittings, I think, but really to allow the ice cube of me to come into the light of the sun, and to actually just start, for that period of time, just to melt a little bit. Melt a little bit. To not be so sure about things. Not to be so convinced. Not to form and allow our practice to form around greater spiritual opinions. But just to allow that sense of me to be seen. What is it that's holding and propping me up in this particular moment? What is it that I'm trying to work out? Not to go to where I'm working things out, but to the sense of me needing to work things out. Because if you look behind the symptoms is working out a particular thing. I need to work something out. If you look behind that, you see one of the mechanisms that drives the sense of self. If we get caught up in the symptom of that drive, then we just work things out. We just have to think about things. We have to figure things out. We have to try to... But if we go back and say, okay, what is this working out? What does that have to do? Well, it keeps me defined. When I work things out, that's one of the strategies that allows me to continue. Instead of just moving on and through the strategies of how the me continually creates itself, to go back and say, okay, what's going on here? The speed of our lives is one of the symptoms. How quickly and how often we hold ourselves to the turmoil of doing. Ever fast, ever more speed. That waterfall effect on our life. Why do we do that, you see? Because the me needs it. Because the me needs it as a strategy for its survival. All of these things that we're going to be talking about in the next 8 weeks are strategies for survival. Not of the organism, but of the sense of me, the sense of I. And you think, well, without that, would there be an organism? Without that, there would only be wonder. You know, I'm sort of getting off my main line of pursuit this evening, but I just want to just show you, like, we take one of the precepts, refrain from saying that which is not true. Okay, so then people get into their wise speech mode, and give very focused attention on everything they say, in order, almost as if they're watching themselves speak, kind of a crowded method, in a very guarded way, so they make sure they don't say any of the ways that wise speech are defined, harsh speech or cruel speech or distorted speech, etc. But they don't see that keeping or focusing in on themselves with such critical attention does nothing to the sense of the speaker. May do a lot for the way we speak, but it does nothing to understand the speaker. And so much of our speech is speech for self-validation. Because we hurt inside, we have such a diminished sense of ourself. If we have a sense of self in this culture, it's usually diminished. We look into somebody's eyes for reassurance that we have some sense of importance or some sense of validity in the world. You can see, you know, the tenderness, there's enormous pain in that, and I'm not ridiculing it at all because it's so painful, but you can see in somebody else's, please verify me. Please acknowledge me. Please just... And so our speech is often from that intention, and it may be very quiet speech, very appropriate speech, but it has the intention for self-validation. So we can't get lost in the trappings of Buddhism. We have to go to the heart of Buddhism, because the trappings will just lead to further solidification of I, me, and mine. We have to go to the heart of it. And to do that, we have to go into the experience of what it means to be alive, the experience of it. And so we might first want to start checking out our experience. And I can say only thing I know about myself is that as far as I know, that as long as I've been alive, I've been around. Fair statement. I can't exactly say at this point that I've been constantly changing. That seems a little strange. As a matter of fact, there feels like something that remains kind of unchanging throughout the decades of life. But then I can't say that I'm completely unchanging, because I see my character and temperament changing. So that's not a very big help, just to look at myself historically. I start reading the religious texts, and I come to Buddhism that says no self, and I read a Hindu text that says self, with a capital S. And I read spiritual literature in Christianity that says no soul, and I go back to Buddhism, or that says soul, and I go back to Buddhism that says no soul. So now I'm completely confused. Self, no self, soul, no soul, change, not changing. Who am I? Who am I? What is the experience of me? And at this point, all we can say is, I don't know. I don't really know. And I'd like to hold us on that I don't know. It's probably better to stay away from being too opinionated about anatta, because when you're opinionated, you try to convince people of anatta. Like this. When he was old, I tried to introduce him to the Buddhist doctrine of selflessness. I thought it would ease any anxiety he might be having about the imminence of death. Ultimately, I began, "Father, you never were." "Well, maybe not," said my father, peering over the rim of his glasses. "But I made a hell of a splash where I should have been." So that doesn't work. It doesn't work. So when I look at myself, I can see that I have a lot of opinions about me. And it might be said that all of that is formed around my name. I was given a name when I was little. It's a little bit like dragging a magnet through iron filings. When you're given a name, you're given the magnet, and it starts the journey of the dragging of the iron of the magnet through filings that line up around your name. Because once we receive a name and have a name, we then begin to generate a history with that name. We begin to sense of ourselves as being accomplished or not, of having a historical reference to that name, having a sense of traits and characteristics and skills, having a whole emotional framework around that. And we see that as we live, the name gets steeped in history, get steeped with a lot of tales, get steeped with a lot of storyline around that name. And the name continues for as long as we continue. And I also see that the more name and recognition I give myself, the more fixed I become within that name and recognition. The more I know myself, the more particularized, the more defined I become. And it's important to understand that the self, the sense of self, doesn't really care whether you're having a good life or a bad life. It wants a defined life. And if you're miserable, well, that's okay from its point of view, because misery keeps you embedded within the tissues of I, me, and mine as much as enjoyment or arrogance. It just cares about the iron filings that's following you as the magnet is pulled. And you know, when on a retreat, you can see people as they begin to stop for the first time. And may I say that the self, above all else, does not want to stop. It can't collect any more iron filings if it's frozen, if it's just stopped. And it requires the fixation of these filings to be attached to itself for it to be known. And on retreat, as we begin to release ourselves from some of the baggage that we have carried, you can feel the screams from each one of us as that baggage is released or relaxed. It's really the screams of insecurity without it. It's like, I need this. Don't take it from me. As it begins to slip its hold off of us, as it begins to release itself, as we do nothing, which is the art of Buddhism, of not doing, those things which have gathered around us and defined us begin to be shed. We don't hold ourselves with such strict definition. And there's an enormous agony of spirit that we go through as we allow these things to be shed. It's not that we force them off, but we're just so used to having them, we don't know who we are without them, and we are loath to give them up. And we really, literally, are in some kind of tortured shape. And then the retreat unfolds, and then we find the beauty of not having that baggage with us. And then all of a sudden it becomes very easy, very light. And then the retreat ends and we quickly grab the baggage right back. It was almost as if we didn't recognize why it is that we were much more content in the middle of the retreat than we were on either side. We don't allow ourselves to consider the possibility that simplicity might have something to do with contentment, because that runs counter to everything we've learned and everything we hold ourselves to be. And so simplicity becomes our greatest angst, really. And the stronger and more tenacious we hold ourselves to the content of our lives and the definition of all the baggage that we carry, the more defined we are in relationship to that content. And the content defines us beautifully. Think what, just ask, reflect upon your life and try to get a sense of who you are. What definitions do you come up with? how would you define yourself? Well, I can do this, I'm this, I live here. I'm skilled at this, I'm not so good at that. By the content of our lives, that's how we have defined ourselves. Take away the content, which is what happens when we are quiet. There's this period of uncertainty about who we are. And the uncertainty is so strong that we will quickly pick up the content again and say, well, that sitting was good, except, boy, I just had to work myself through that interview I have this morning, and then I battled with sleepiness all day, and then besides that, it was a really good sitting. See, the content becomes the definition of the sitting itself. Also notice that the sense of you, of me, of your life, of who you think you are, doesn't ever or rarely feel complete. It feels like you're moving towards something. It feels like we're on a path where we have so much and that we're really what we need to make our lives actualized, complete, is a little more time. I have to do a little more of something. I have to be a little more of this or a little more of that. I have to be better skilled. I have to be brighter. I have to be kinder. I have to be something. The sense of I, the embodiment of I, is never content, because the embodiment of I can't be content because it lives within what I need, what I expect, what I fear, what I want. In fact, in Buddhist language, it just gets a little more subtle, but I want to take you there because you can't really discuss the self in Buddhist terminology without this. So I'll just use a metaphor. The self is formed in this way. Think of it as like a high dive. The person makes contact with the high dive board. And depending upon the weight of that wanting or fearing, the board bends considerably or little. But let's say it bends considerably. The contact, I really want this. At the time of that, the weight comes down and the board flips us up into the air. At that point, thought takes over. We are flipped up into the ozones of thought. And thought begins to build itself around what I want, what I need, what I have to have in order for my life to be perfect. The problem is that we're in the air, we're not on the ground, and eventually the air, the person, drops to the ground, except he doesn't just drop gently, he falls. So what I want, I had to leave the floor, I had to leave the ground and float into my thinking. And when the thinking is always about the future, what I need in the future, what I have to have, what I fear might become. And as soon as the sense of me from that thought hits the ground of reality, there's a crunch and pain ensues. But the I, the me, is driven by the wanting or the fearing of something in the future. And that's why when we embody the sense of I or me or mine, we're constantly incomplete except when we think about the future. Because the way the sense of me is formed is future-oriented, is desire-oriented, is not what I have but what I need in order to be complete. Therefore, the present moment for the sense of me is always a diminished sense of presence. It's never a complete presence. It's a diminished sense. This presence is only good for where it will take me in the future so that I can become whole and complete. That's the way we relate to the present moment. So the present isn't what's happening. This isn't where I want to be. I want to be somewhere else. A little bit like this Kabir poem. Friends, please tell me what I can do about this world. I hold to it and keep spinning out. I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but I noticed one day the cloth was well woven. So I bought some burlap, but I still throw it elegantly over my shoulder. I pull back my sexual longings, and now I discover that I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice that I'm greedy all day. I work hard at dissolving the greed, and now I'm proud of myself. When the mind wants to break its link with the world, it still holds on to one thing. That no matter how it is that we try, whatever we're doing is always a statement about something that we have become, something that we are becoming, something that has yet to be completed, something that I have yet to be satisfied with. I was watching a cartoon. You know how the cartoons, they come to a cliff and then the thing continues over the cliff? Like a blur? That's sort of what the sense of self is. It's like always just a blur out in front of itself. It's never about standing on the ground, terra firma. It's always about the blur that's up just ahead. And so, the sense of me requires time in order to survive. It also requires resistance in order to survive. It requires creating our definition as opposed to someone else's definition. It requires holding on to one's self-image, not just for oneself, but in contrast to people it can judge and put down, so therefore it can enhance its own self-image. So the sense of me is a constant contradiction with life. It's in constant expectation of life paying off to some degree or other. It's in constant movement towards life becoming something that it isn't already. Again, get a sense of these qualities in ourselves. Get a sense of how we as a human being, how you as a human being hold yourself in resistance to other people, to other things, so that you can be defined, so that you can be known to yourself. We do this through judgment, which is a resistance, put somebody else down. I can know my own sense of self-definition to a greater degree. Complaining. Objecting to anything. Any negativity defines my outline as opposed to that which I'm negative about. And we wonder why our minds are laced with that kind of readied negativity, of judgment, of comparison, of evaluation, or longing, or wanting. Or fearing. All of those wanting, longing, fearing, judging, condemning, pencil in the dots. If you're just dots, not so content. But when you pencil in and you have a person, now we can relax a little bit. We can relax within our resistance. We're defined. We know ourselves. So this series is an attempt to get to understand how it is that we create from those dots a sense of me. And in order for us to see that this is a universal trait, we're going to have to apply ourselves to universal truths. And so the homework is an attempt to do just that. Because most of us have the belief that everyone else has it together but me. I mean, have you ever thought that? I mean, you look around the room and, well, she certainly has it together. Or she. But none of us do. In fact, do you ever feel a little phony? Like people think you have it all together and inside you're on the shakiest grounds that you could possibly be? Pieces of you are feeling like 7.0 earthquake? Why is that? And is it just you? No. It's the nature of the sense of me, the universal me, that we just don't have it together. There are no self-actualized. Self-actualization is an oxymoron. To have the self is to be embedded in longing, in resistance, in time. So remember that the point of the meditation is not to encourage resistance, time, longing, or fear. It is to allow that sense of stopping to occur so that those patterns of mind that drive us can be seen, so that we begin to know how the self is created, not move from the symptoms and strategies of the self to create more of me, but to drop back and to see how the me is created from those sense of patterns, strategies. Because the sense of me is literally one concept deep. And what's underneath that concept when we allow our minds to touch the stillness? True contentment. Not contentment in the future, but contentment now. True stopping, where fear and longing cannot enter. Timelessness, where the self is no longer searching in the future for its comfort and joy, not happiness, but joy of just being. So the Buddha's teaching is about what's underneath the patterns driving it, not following the patterns towards more self-creation. It's a very difficult subject for me to communicate and for you to hear and practice. So together, we're going to struggle with this thing. But I'm committed to doing it because without that base of understanding, this practice really the depth of this practice is being denied totally. If it shakes us, okay. That's okay. It should shake us. We should know that something's happening. We should feel shaky. Whoa. If this thing pushes us enough, it's okay. We can feel a little shaky. So let us enjoy the journey together in these 8 weeks. Can we sit for a minute or two?